Hello, it is January 20th, 2017. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 629 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports on earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and thank you for spending part of your day with me. First off, I have an apology to make. Earlier this week, I taped a podcast with Sigmund Bloom, who runs one of the co-founders of footballguys.com and one of the great minds behind one of my favorite NFL podcasts, The Audible, which you should subscribe to. I subscribe to it. That's why I know he's so good. That's why I had him on my podcast, or at least attempted to, earlier this week. But I have a new computer that I have not adjusted all the audio settings on, and we lost the podcast. I've been doing this podcast for more than 4 years, and this has literally never happened. I finally have the guy on. I've been wanting to have on for a long time to preview the conference championship games, and we lost it. So first off, this is an apology to Sigmund Bloom, who is a terrific football mind. And trust me, had a lot of very awesome things to say about the conference championship games. I could hear him, but you would have not been able to. So anyway, much frustration. I even got my friends at NPR, like they have like the best equipment in the world, and they were unable to salvage the audio. So very frustrating. I apologize to Sigmund. Follow him at Sigmund Bloom on Twitter. He is the guy that knows the NFL. So that is my apology. That's why we did not have two podcasts this week instead of we only have this one. Fortunately for me and for you, the podcast that I have for today is an excellent one that I'm pretty sure is going to record. My guest today is Matt Giles. He is actually a colleague of mine at New York Magazine. He wrote a long piece for us at Sports on Earth. He's one of the best basketball minds you'll know. He's a terrific college basketball guy. I'm constantly bothering him about Georgia and Illinois, not in that order, all year. But he wrote an incredibly fascinating piece for us at Sports on Earth called The Murder of Michael Wright. Michael Wright is a former Arizona basketball player who, and a Knicks draft pick, who was discovered murdered at the end of 2015, disappeared in 2015. And as it turned out, it's just quite a fascinating story to find out who did it, who has been accused of the crime, Wright's history, his association with the man that was accused of the crime. It's a fascinating story. Giles had an interview with the man who has been accused of murdering Michael Wright, Mark Holdbrooks, Michael's quote-unquote uncle. It's an incredible story. Definitely go to sportsnorth.com and read it. And I'm going to talk to Matt about it in just a moment. I remind you, as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice review. But don't mention the fact that I accidentally killed a podcast with Sigmund Bloom because it was a good one and I really just feel awful about it. But this one's going to work. Here is Matt Giles to talk about his story on Michael Wright. All right, Matt, first off, thank you for coming on. I'm going to do what I can not to spend this entire podcast just talking like I usually talk with you about, which is how Illinois and Georgia are doing on the bubble. Which is what
right,
I
usually exactly.
want to talk to you about. Because you, of course, in addition to writing this terrific piece, know basketball, specifically college basketball, as well as anybody I know. But we're going to talk about the Michael Wright piece. You've been working on this piece for a while. We'll get into how this story came together in a bit. But really, give me the basic, the story of Michael Wright. I remember Michael Wright when he played for Arizona, but for those that don't remember Michael Wright vividly as a player and what the arc his career was kind of going, give us a little background on him and then that kind of let us lead into Mark Holdbrooks.
For sure. Start off, thanks for having me on.
Oh, please. So
Michael was sort of part of one of the greatest, I guess, Arizona teams, probably of all, I would say, of all in the Lute Olson era. I mean, he was on the third team that ever went to the final. Third team to ever go to the Final Four, second team to ever make the championship game. They lost to very equally talented Duke team that Elton Brand, Trajan Langdon years. And he was sort of the star of a team that had a lot of stars. Gilbert Arenas, Luke Walton, Jason Gardner, Lauren Woods. I mean, this was a very jacked Pac-10 team. And he was sort of Draymond without the jumper. I mean, sort of this very muscular. You could dump it down to him in the post and he would get either score or draw the foul. He shot 85 to 90% on his free throws. So he was going to automatically make 2 points. And just was very a dependable low post scorer for a team that probably, I mean, it was a high major team that was utilizing sort of a mid-major concept of going with like a undersized four instead of like what everyone was using in NBA at the time was multiple seven footers. But everyone I talked to, and from, I mean, I remember watching those Arizona teams and sort of being obsessed with Michael Wright and also just how good he was, how soft his hands were, how he always seemed to box someone out. And just from talking to everyone, I mean, Jason Gardner said he was cash money anytime he caught the ball. He was just sort of the most under-recognized, but also at the same time, best player on the team.
So he went. So he played Arizona and then briefly played for the Knicks or was drafted by the Knicks, but kind of made his career really kind of playing overseas. At what point around this time he meets Mark Holdbrooks. Who is Mark Holdbrooks? How does he come across him initially, and what is their relationship?
He also, by the way, he also played with Kevin Garnett too in high school, which was also one of the greatest ever high school teams ever assembled in Illinois history. So he meets Mark Holdbrooks. No one really knows how they met. A few people said they met maybe on Michael was on a 16U team in high school, but it really seems that probably wasn't the case just because Mark was actually in prison at that point. We'll get to that later. But it seems like they met either freshman or sophomore year, which would have been 1998-99, 1999-2000, when Michael was at Arizona. How it sort of seems like is that Mark introduced himself to Michael's mother and sort of informally offered to mentor her youngest son, Michael's one of two, and just sort of kind of take him through, you know, this guy's a McDonald's All-American. Everyone's talking about him as being a future first-round draft pick, sort of show him the ropes. Mark came from this very well-established family in Harlem. They had, I think, 2 to 3 brownstones on Stryper's Row, which is at that point in the 80s, 90s, was a very well-connected area of Harlem. He was the big man on campus within the parish church. He was a very big deal. So to have someone like Mark Holdbrooks say he was going to mentor Michael, that was huge.
All right, so but their relationship then lasts for a decade and seems to be obviously they're very close and they live together at some point. But this seems to be fraught. You kind of talk about how some of their associates find the relationship sometimes kind of curious or maybe codependent. Did he just supports him? Or what was the relationship like, and how did it kind of evolve?
I mean, basically, everyone who I spoke with said their relationship was very much mentor-mentee, but more so uncle-nephew. I mean, it was really Mark is 24 years older than Michael. And so he really is sort of this symbiotic. At first, it's, I'm going to show you how to do certain things, but then it's going to be, we are in this co-relationship together. It's almost like life partners, but in a sense of just two people who have some sort of future goal and they're getting there together. It's almost like, you know, in New York, everyone has roommate. You can have a roommate for 20 years and you're best friends with them. That's sort of how it seems like with Michael and Mark. And especially for Michael, he was overseas playing in Europe for 6 to 7 months out of the year. And Mark would be home taking care of contracts, taking care of financial obligations, taking care of rent. Just basically doing the things that sort of like a personal assistant that Michael would have needed someone to take care of.
So then he seems to be getting close to the end of his career. And then in November of 2015, he disappears. And the case, there's a lot of theories as to why he disappears. And around this time, you interviewed Holdbrooks. When did you interview Holdbrooks? How long after the disappearance did you interview him?
So it was a long process. It was, I interviewed, so Michael disappears November 5th. The body is found November 10th. I interviewed Mark Holdbrooks in, I think, June 9th. I can remember the day because it was I was actually had repeated Facebook messages calling random numbers, emailing random accounts, trying to find some way to get him to reach him. And he's Michael's closest friend for 20 years. Michael didn't have he didn't have a large periphery of friends, but if you were his friend, it was so intimately close. And a lot of those people didn't at first want to talk to me. They said, no comment. I don't feel comfortable talking to you. It had taken a long process of just trying to get Mark to actually feel comfortable talking to me. Actually, I had spoke to their pastor a week before and sort of put in like a last ditch plea, if he could put in a good word for me, with Mark. And I got a Facebook message and in late May, and we set up. I went out to Closter, which is probably about 30 minutes outside the city, to go visit him for like a 5 to 6 hour talk.
And I don't want to get ahead of the narrative a little bit, but certainly he seemed, in the way you kind of described the conversation, you know, generally open. And I mean, you talked for 5 or 6 hours, for crying out loud. There's a lot that came out of that. What was your impression of him when personally when you spoke to him?
I mean, as someone who clearly is very good at sort of small talk and making conversation, and he was very open, what I thought was very open. We were talking a lot about sort of, basically was trying to find out how this individual who made a lot of money overseas and sort of became one of the best Americans to play overseas within the past decade, died at, you know, was found murdered.
Brutally murdered
in, you know, axe to the back of the head, blunt force trauma, covered in garbage bags on like a street that's a block away from DeFaro's in Brooklyn, sort of this very residential, leafy neighborhood in Brooklyn. And so he was very open and he wanted to set the record straight. He said there are people speaking on behalf of Michael who Michael would never allow to speak about him, and how there's all sorts of rumors flying out there, and he only wanted the best, most accurate portrayal of Michael to be presented.
Okay, and so you're like, wow, okay, this is good. A lot of people would have wanted this interview. You worked a long time on it. This is still a mystery. This is still an unsolved case. So that's June, and then we come up to around November when it is supposed to be. It's about the year anniversary of the disappearance and what turned out to be the murder, and New York City police arrest Holdbrooks for the murder. I'm just curious, as someone that talked to him for that long, what was your thought when you saw that news come across?
I mean, immediately I started thinking about all the quotes that he had given me that were like, you know, now in context, this seems extremely weird. Some of the stuff from the piece, just talking about seeing Michael's face and how it looked like multiple people were beating him. And obviously this is all alleged, you know, even right now.
Of course.
But I mean, some of these quotes and how he spoke about not really wanting closure, of just letting it sort of fade away. And maybe it's a little bit easier in retrospect. It you know, sort of hits my stomach. And actually my editor, I had not seen the news like that evening. Gabe, the editor of the piece, mm-hmm. who did a great job, emailed me and was like, did you know about this? And I immediately started calling every source again.
Yes.
Saying, what the fuck? And trying to get basically everyone who wouldn't speak to me, just saying, all right, this is completely changed now. You have to, like, we've got to talk. What's going on?
So again, it was an unsolved case when you talked to him. And this is a strange thing to ask in retrospect, but I mean, you know, obviously one of the theories that the press ran with, the theory that at one point I think was floated by Holdbrooks, that he had met a hookup gone bad on Grindr or something like that, and the Holdbrooks had kind of encouraged that idea. But this was still an unsolved case when you talked to him. Did it mm-hmm. ever even occur to you that? Like, did he seem shady at all? I mean, again, this is alleged, but clearly the police have some reason to make this arrest. I mean, obviously you didn't think when you would say them in the interview, oh, well, this is, maybe he killed him. But certainly, what about now that you've, you've seen the arrest, and you've seen, and there's a little bit more perspective, and we can talk about that in a moment, of what you kind of know about him and their relationship. What did their relationship seem fraught? What have you learned about him since the interview that has maybe shed some more light on some of the things that came that you were thinking during that interview?
I mean, it was weird because I guess to put in context, not many, Michael did not have a very wide circle of friends. And so finding the people who were close to him took a lot of tracking them A down and then just B asking them. And a lot of them were just like, they would give you great, you know, some good anecdotes, but it was clear they weren't great friends with him. And the people who I figured were better friends with him, just from doing Facebook legwork and sort of a little bit of Facebook stalking, weren't willing to talk to me. They said no comment. They didn't feel comfortable about it. So when Mark said, yes, I will talk to you, I want, you know, and Mark says, I want to be the representative for the family to sort of do this, it was sort of like this. The furthest thing from my mind was that he would be alleged, you know, he'd be arrested, because this is someone who it made sense. He was the closest person to him. He was the only, it seemed like he was the only one who'd be able to sort of help me or sort of explain what went wrong with Michael, what, you know, how this seemingly great person spun off the rails. And that was the narrative portrayed. I mean, after the fact, you're looking back and seeing things that he was telling other people that knew Michael a lot better, that they said that didn't make sense at all. And that was sort of clues for them that something was off. And in fact, a lot of those friends stopped talking to Mark probably 2 or 3 months after the murder, just because they didn't feel really comfortable anymore. They thought something was weird. And Mark, in fact, cut off communications with them as well. He stopped talking to them totally. And so, I mean, at that time doing the interview, there was nothing really to key me in on that this is strange. Reading through the interview again after November 1st, definitely. But at that point, there was really nothing.
So what's the, you know, it's also worth noting too, is not shortly before the disappearance, but a year before the disappearance, Holdricks was diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Yes. This was his second bout with cancer. Yeah.
Okay. So, and therefore Wright felt obliged to come back and help because he was paying for a lot of his treatment. He advised to come back and not necessarily play as much overseas. I'm curious, is that like, what did the police say? Have they said what the motive is? Like, it's, you touch on a little bit in the story, but what is the police theory of the case, or have they even released that yet?
No, they haven't released that at all. I mean, we do touch on this a bit in the piece that Michael made a lot of money overseas. Was one of, I guess to take it back a little bit, the recession hit overseas basketball very hard, and a lot of players who were accustomed to making a great deal of money saw their salaries cut nearly half to three quarters. But Michael was a player that was immune to that because of his reputation, because that he was scoring champion several years, because he was MVP for several leagues. He was sort of this dominant force that even with the recession, his salary wasn't going to get touched. So he had made a lot of money. I mean, Mike Maine, his agent, started representing him around 2009, 2010, when he changed his name, or when he adopted Ali Karadeniz, his name, when he played in Turkey, and after his ACL surgeries. And from that point, Michael made $4 million or so. And that was even before, that's sort of the tail end. So there's a lot of money that was being made. So while the police have not said that's a motive, given Mark's history and what he has actually been convicted for, it would be foolhardy to assume that's something that they're not looking into.
So to have all of these turns kind of come around, you talked a little bit before about how you called a lot of people after Holdricks got arrested. Obviously, this is a story you've been following for a long time. Have you talked to like, is now everybody shut up since their arrest happened? Is there some of the people that you've talked to about Wright in the past, are they speaking about Holdricks, or is everyone kind of radio silence now?
One person who I, you know, spoke to a little bit, who is one of the people who I had reached out to originally, who had said, I don't feel comfortable talking, one of his best friends in New York, They met actually because they were both, I don't actually know if the friend was a vegetarian, but Michael was a vegetarian. He choked on a chicken breast while at Boat Basin Cafe, and after that he swore off all meat. And so this friend became, again, the same way that Holbrooks was the de facto spokesperson for Michael's friends, this friend became sort of filled in that role. And no, they haven't gone radio silent, but I think that there's definitely more of certain people were not as receptive to speak with me. You know, arranged interviews went, you know, just kind of went, the phone went unanswered. And I think that's also because, you know, I'm sure there's some confusion as well of what's going on out there. And this case is, especially since Mark has yet to be extradited to New Jersey, he's still sitting in a jail cell in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Detention Complex, and on Atlantic Avenue. And so because of that, they still have to extradite him. They still actually have to convene a grand jury in Bergen County. He has been arrested and charged, but they still need to convene a grand jury. So this is just this process is going to take a very long time.
Is there a you talk a little bit about the context of, for a lot of people, about how there was a recession in overseas basketball, even if it didn't affect him that much. But is there, you've talked to a lot of athletes, you've covered basketball for a long time. Is this kind of relationship that he had with Holbrooks, regardless of how it ended, is that common? Like, it's funny because we think of, you know, the NBA players always having like people, a lot of people they find themselves like taking care of a lot of people, and then all of a sudden a lot of people that just kind of exist to be their friend or to take care of things for them. Is this relationship common for people overseas? Is it just people at that level? Like, is there a general takeaway from this story? Or I guess the real question is there a general takeaway from this story that we can learn about something larger? Or is this really, because every time I it's hard to even get your arms around the story sometimes. That's why I encourage everyone to make sure to go out and read it, because it seems like the circumstances are so unique and strange, and there's cancer, and then there's his sexuality, and there's just so many different strange things. Is this just a unique, weird circumstance that somehow almost inexplicably ended in murder? Or is there a larger thing where you're like, oh, this reminds me of a lot of stuff I've come across before?
I honestly think, you know, in certain aspects, there's a group of people that would help. I mean, for every player, there's probably several or so other people who are helping that person out. I mean, obviously, business contracts, day-to-day type of stuff, you know, scheduling. I mean, every single player probably has that sort of aspect. With Michael, it might have been a little bit more unique because it was just one individual who sort of took care of everything. I mean, it was not just business relationship, not just for contracts, it's life skill advice. So it's stuff about what he should be doing for the next career. Mark was a sounding board for him. Whether, you know, after he's retiring, should he be going into the healthcare industry? Should he be going into nursing? Maybe he should do training camps for kids to raise money to pay for college, to pay for, you know, whatever he needs to do for that. It's raising his daughter, Daisha. It's finishing his degree. So I think for this person, it really was more unique than any other sort of relationship because there was such a dependency. And Mark, when I did the interview with him, talked about how he didn't want to be an enabler. I think there was a little bit of that going on where just because of how long they've been together and how much the two of their lives were intertwined, that did happen.
So where is the next step? Like this, they've made the arrest. Eventually, like, are they going to make – is there not enough – maybe this story will help that. This feels like the type of somewhat high-profile case where the police would have to give some sort of theory of the case. Do we have to wait until arraignment? Has he been arraigned? What's the next step in the trial version of this?
So right now what's happening is there's going to be another hearing – so to back up, his alleged accomplice, David Victor, who no one really knows who this person is, how he met Mark. He's just sort of this unknown person from Brooklyn. He has already been extradited, so he is sitting in a Bergen County cell awaiting. We're not 100% sure. The DA hasn't really commented on what they're sort of waiting for. I'm assuming they're waiting for Mark to also be extradited as well. So the next step for Mark, though, is that he's gone through several hearings. Next hearing is the 24th of January. And so what basically happened was the governor of New Jersey, it's called a governor's warrant, and he has to petition the state of New York to extradite Mark within 90 days of the arrest.
Okay.
And so if this is actually, it's really, it's comically, it's funny, but in a very weird legal sense. So if that deadline passes, New York can technically release Mark Holbrooks, and then they would just rearrest him, and New Jersey would have to file a governor's warrant again for another 90 days. They would have another 90 days to file a governor's warrant. So he could just sit in a New York cell for 90-day increments until New Jersey files that governor's warrant. And they since they have yet to do that.
So this could go on for, like, I'm very baffled. So what, this could go on for a long time before we even have any idea what's going on.
Yes, basically. I mean, the New Jersey, Bergen County is not commenting really until he gets to Bergen County. But because that warrant has yet to be filed, he's just kind of hanging out in the Brooklyn Detention Complex, sort of basically doing as much as he can to not get extradited.
Because that's when it really starts moving.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow. So, well, Matt, it's a terrific story, and it's funny because, you know, there's so many, it's such a hard story. It's hard as a reader to get your mind around the story that I can't imagine what it was like to report it out, particularly now when, like, you get all the way to this point and we still don't actually have a theory of the case, and we may not know for a continuing series of 90-day increments.
There's still so many question marks that just no one can really answer. I mean, why did the relationship sour? How was the connection to David Victor? There was an element of it where Michael felt he was being drugged. He would go out to nightclubs and would inexplicably collapse at home. He got into a car crash over the GW Bridge that he said he only had a half a drink and he felt like he was drugged. There are all these elements to it that, you know, was someone actually drugging him? There's all these things that no one really has answers to because of how complex this, you know, sort of case is.
All right. Well, you just got to read the story. And I'm very excited to see. I mean, you're on this piece now, right? Like, you're not going, you're on this story now. Cause this feels like for all the turns it's taken and all, it's a legitimate murder mystery, but we're still in the middle of it.
Yes.
And we're still in the middle of the whole thing. So, it feels like you'll be able to write a story. I don't know if this is good for your mental health or not, but you're going to be able to write another story of this length and breadth in a year with all the new developments that come out.
I hope so. So basically Mark, according to the criminal complaint, Mark stopped cooperating with authorities May 15th, May 18th or so. And it took them, it then went 6 months until he was charged. So there is still a lot of steps to be played out in this.
Right. The wheels of justice actually grind more slowly than the wheels of journalism, which is pretty slow, actually.
Right.
Actually, I guess not so much anymore. But with this story, yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, man, it's a terrific story. Everyone go to sportsjournalist.com and check it out. I know that you've been working on this for a while, and it really came out great. And I feel weird saying, it really came out great. Congratulations. Because I'm like, nah, your work's just getting started on this, actually.
And it's also weird to think about that, too, because it's like this whole sad thing that's drawn in not only these two individuals, but, you know, Michael's daughter, Mark's daughter. This whole it's a very sad human element into this as well.
All right. Well, I look forward to further updates on this. I know it took a long time for the story to come out, and as I said, I feel like that's a hard thing for you. I can't imagine because you work so long and hard on this, and all through all these different intonations, and you're just getting started. This is just the beginning of this. So you did not give birth to this. You just you started out the next thing. But all right. Well, listen. Regardless, I've actually been wanting to have you on to talk about college basketball for a while. So we will do that at some point in a later podcast. So maybe we'll get. I've been wanting to do a big, massive. I always have Matt Norlander on to do the tournament preview, but I'd love to once we get in there, I'd love to have you get chat about that because this is, of course, just the tip of the iceberg for the stuff that you do. But this is so it's a terrific piece. Everyone, go read it. And by all means, Matt, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And yeah, I'd love to talk college hoops. We get Craig's on here to talk about Illinois as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. You know, it's, you know that, of course, because, you know, Craig's as well as I do. And I actually texted him tonight because I'm going to be in New York the night that Northwestern plays at Illinois.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And of course, you know, even though Craig's grew up in Champaign, he betrayed his people of Champaign by going to Northwestern. Famously, his mother, when I interviewed her for Deadspin, said, yeah, he didn't like the people there. They weren't real like the people in Champaign. I was like, yeah, damn right they're not.
It's Chicago's only Big Ten team, though.
Yes, yes, exactly. As I said before, I'll say it again. I feel comfortably that they are in the top three of Evanston's Big Ten teams. I think I'm very confident they have that going for them. All right, so everyone, of course, you're on Twitter. You're at Hudson Giles, correct?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So everyone follow him at Hudson Giles, and you'll be able to see more updates about this and get a bunch of great college football basketball stuff. Otherwise, we'll be back. I apologize again to Sigmund Bloom for losing his podcast earlier this week. We'll be back next week, probably to talk. We're going to talk some baseball pretty soon. I got to get Allison back on. We're going to do some more baseball stuff. I've not actually done a baseball podcast since the World Series. I wonder why. Otherwise, have a great weekend, everyone. Enjoy the conference championship games, and we will talk next week.